from the species that you're
No?
Yeah, it should be on.
Okay, very good. Okay. Well, I'm very happy and scared for the opportunity to talk about this. I've actually gotten a bit sick of talking about this idea, but given the challenge of the way that David put it, of all the smart people here, many of whom know much more astronomy than I do, I couldn't resist. I thought that what I would do is, however, start with some remarks, so sort of 3 minutes on some basic motivation for why this kind of theory, because the theory that I'll explain to you, and this is one of the points, is, I think, falsifiable, and not only that, quite vulnerable to being falsified and not unlikely to be falsified in the near future. So half of my purpose is to seek help in getting the theory proved false, but the other half is that there is a reason why I think this kind of theory may get us out of some of the quagmires of present-day sort of fundamental theory, and therefore the challenge is not only to kill this theory, but to invent something better. So I'll start with some opening remarks. Then I'll summarize the theory in a list of assumptions, and then I'll state what my reading of the present status of the evidence for the theory, which is based on lots of help by astronomers and cosmologists to try to kill it. And then I'll be happy, having done that, I'll outline how one tries to kill it, that is, what are the vulnerable points, and then I think I'll be happy to take cases, because I don't have time to talk about all the cases, so I'm happy to take cases, and maybe, or even likely, there'll be things that people haven't thought about. Okay. So, thinking about presenting this, I was actually struck by, on Tuesday, Abai presented these results on quantization of area and volume, and they came from the same sort of few months of thinking of this idea, and both ideas were really aimed at answering two questions. The first question was, are there any predictions that can be made from quantum gravity given our very incomplete state of understanding the theory? And I was trying to sort of catalog, coming from what, you know, string theory, black hole thermodynamics work we had done, cosmological ideas, what were the actual predictions that we had from quantum gravity, and could we have more? And both the discreteness of the area and volume and this idea that I'll present were attempts to increase the number of predictions coming from quantum gravity. And the game in both cases was to try to find things which could be robust predictions in the absence of a lot of detail, and certainly in the absence of a complete formulation. And the second question is that in general relativity and in quantum gravity, the nature of things which are physically observable from which we get predictions is quite different from standard quantum field theories, because all observables are about relationships between things. And this is a philosophical theme that could be expanded on at length, and I won't. But the question is, are there new kinds of observables, new kinds of experimental tests that arise in theories where all the things which are observable are relational, in the sense that all the physical observables are based on relationships in general relativity? And that was the second question. And I think that this theory, which I'll present, is kind of the answer, or shows that those two questions are intimately related to each other, that we make our theories of quantum gravity more predictable and more vulnerable to being falsified by taking into account the large extent to which things are relational and therefore dynamically determined. Okay, so that's just sort of some opening remarks. When one thinks about the parameters of nature, as we understand them, we have the standard model of particle physics and standard model of cosmology. There are several different ideas on the table about how they might be explained. Okay. There is, of course, the idea that fundamental physics is going to explain them from first principles completely. And the particular idea I'll present was motivated by the situation as it was then developing and is still true, that in string theory, which is our best version of a unification of all the interactions, and I think by now the evidence for that is even much stronger than sort of 1990, at least at weak coupling, it doesn't solve the problem of how to explain the parameters, because at weak coupling, string theory seems to have a big space of dynamically determined parameters, or what string theory is called the moduli space. That is, there's a big space, and sort of M, okay, which labels the possible vacua or solutions of the theory. And this space labels as well both the possible physical phases of the theory and the parameters which govern those physical phases, which seem to be free parameters. And what we're missing is a theory of how the point in this space, presumably there is a point in this space that describes our world, is chosen. And maybe there is such a dynamical principle, but I'd like to show you that maybe we don't need such a principle. Maybe there are other considerations that lead to that. Okay. The other idea that strikes one when one starts to think about this is, and especially talk to astronomers, is this whole literature on something called the anthropic principle. And the anthropic principle, I don't think, is a physical theory or is even a scientific theory, even in its weak form. Okay. But the anthropic principle, just to state one version of the weak anthropic principle, the universe gets made for some reason in zillions and zillions of versions, and it more or less uniformly populates the moduli space of parameters. And then you say, gee, we happen to live at a single point there. Why? And the answer is you discover that some version of that's the only place where there could be biology or where there are stars and organic chemistry and so forth is just a little region here. So in the whole ensemble of many universes, which are sort of uniform in some measure on that space, there just has to be one which is like our universe, and that explains why we're here. And that one, not in someone over here, where life couldn't exist. And the problem with that is that that theory already assumes what's to be demonstrated, which is that there's an ensemble, at least one member of which looks like our universe and has the parameters of our universe. But that's easy. We already know that that's true. So the theory can't make any predictions that are falsifiable and is therefore not science. Okay. On the other hand, a lot of smart people have written and advocated the anthropic principle, like Martin Rees and Bernard Carr and Brandon Carter, Fred Hoyle, Robert Dickey, George Ellis, Steve Hawking, Andre Linde, John Barrow, Frank Tipler, the Pope, lots and lots of smart people. And one wants to know why. And the reason is that there do seem to be what they call, quote, coincidences, which is that the observed parameters of elementary particle physics and cosmology seem to be very unusual in that they seem to be in, let me put it this way. Okay. So first of all, we don't measure this yet. We're hoping for progress. We don't measure that. Okay. We measure a space I'll call P of standard model parameters. Okay. And there is some unknown map, which we don't know, but we hope for progress on. Okay. So there's some image of phi in the space of standard model parameters, which we don't know. Okay. And we know that we're here. And what are called all the coincidences that the anthropic principle people rave on and on about is that it seems like there's a tiny little box. I'm not starting with a fight. I'm expressing a point of view. Okay, I'm not starting. Okay. There seems to be, what they point out is that if the parameters are outside that box, then there would not be stars, there would not be any nuclei besides hydrogen in the universe, there would therefore not be chemistry, and there would therefore not be life. Well, of course, we can argue about how well we know the physics there. Okay. But it does seem likely, and these are among the things I'll talk about, that if we wander outside of the box, our universe gets simpler in certain ways. And that's all I'll need, actually. Okay. And so I don't believe in the anthropic principle, although I know what Ted wants to fight about, and I'll be very careful to say things such that he'll agree with him in the end. Okay. I will be very careful at the appropriate moment. Okay. Oh, okay. Then I blew it. Okay. But I think they've raised a problem, which is not only do we have what I was educated as, the hierarchy problem, you know, why is the proton mass so small in Planck units and so forth? Why is the electron mass so small in nuclear physics units? Hadronic physics units. But there seems to be this question of why are we in that box? And so I think that's a question, and the anthropic principle, at least as usually argued for, okay, is a statement of a question and not a statement of an answer. Okay. But I don't really want to fight about that. I just wanted to tell you the motivation. What I want to do is present a theory that I claim not only has the chance of answering this question, but is cleanly falsifiable. Therefore, it's probably false, okay, but that's what I want to help with. Okay? So, what are the assumptions of this theory? First of all, that there is such a moduli space of parameters of the fundamental theory. Okay, that fundamental physics did not, in the end, determine the parameters of itself. Second, that there is such a map, which we don't know, and that the image of that map allows at least some reasonably large region around the present value of the parameters. So that when we vary the point in here, we can explore some region around where we are. Yes?
What is something making about the moduli space? That, for instance, it's smooth rather than just a set of...
I don't care. If it's a set of discrete points, I just care that it populates a lot of points in the neighborhood of here. Okay. My third assumption, okay, is that there can be, when we go to, if we take the vacuum and heat it up to Planck energies or compress it to Planck densities, then the point here can jump by some mechanism like a phase transition. And so that leads to jumps here of order delta p. So I get random jumps of size delta p, okay, and...
Can't you find random here in this context? What would be random?
The interesting thing about this theory is it won't matter. I mean, obviously, I mean, there's some measure here. Okay, put almost any measure you like here. Okay, but I have to say what I mean by small, because that's an important part of the assumption. Okay, and small means... I'll come back in a minute because I have to introduce some more.
Shouldn't Planck make be part of the moduli space anyhow? You said
this is dimensionless. Dimensionless parameters. Okay, just to make things clean.
Is it a one-to-one math? I mean,
I don't care. I don't care.
One-to-many.
Let me lay the whole thing out, and you'll see that you'll see how. Okay. Sure. You'll see how insensitive is the experimental test to the details of these assumptions. Yes.
So you're assuming that that you can change each parameter independently.
No, I'm not yet assuming that. There may very well be, this image may be some subspace. Okay, I don't know it. Okay. But of course, to get a test presently, which I claim, I'm going to have to argue from about what I can do in ignorance of knowing that, which I'll come back to. Okay, I'll come back to what this means. So random jumps, and finally, the big assumption is that black hole singularities, I'll just say black holes bounce. This is an old idea, goes at least back to Johnny Wheeler, if not much earlier. Okay. What that means is that the space-like, well, let me say it even less generically, the singularities inside of black holes are replaced by, before infinite density is reached, by some explosion due, quote, to quantum gravity, which results in that region of space and time therefore expanding. It doesn't, of course, it can't expand back to the past where we could see it. All of this is happening to the future of any observer who would fall through the horizon. So we can't see this, but there is, quote, a new universe, or what's meant by that is a new classical region of space and time, which grows up to the future of where the singularity would have been. Okay. And I'll assume that they bounce and make one new universe. That's a assumption that can be changed. And for example, Frolov and Bonobos and other people who have tried to study this process semi-classically have predicted that the number of universes you get is large and is not one, and I can at some point can say how that affects the assumption. Okay? Now, then I have the following situation. Okay. On the parameter space, I have a function, B, the function on the parameter space, and it is the average number of black holes produced by the bounce of an astrophysical black hole produced by in the region produced to the future of the bounce of some astrophysical black hole. And this function is what the biologists call the fitness function. Why is it the fitness function? Because consider that I take a random start somewhere in the parameter space, okay, and I make a bounce. I make a region. Now, there's some big open region here that would classically have at least one singularity, and that's all I need. So I have to assume that I'm in that region. Okay. And then eventually I get a singularity because space-time's in general relativity. And I'm assuming here the space-times are always compact because this is cosmology. So I get a new space-time and another new one and another new one. And each time I get a new one, I get a random change in this space. And eventually...
Could you give the definition of this B and P again, because I didn't understand how that works.
I assume that I have a astrophysical black hole. I'll come back to why in a minute.
Yeah.
Okay. And I assume that this bounce scenario is true, that there's a big classical space-time that gets created, okay, and there is a number of black holes which form in that.
Yeah.
And this is the average over some ensemble that I'm not telling you because it won't matter.
The average number of black holes for all time to the future of zero?
No, between to the future, the average number of black holes in this one. I'm not counting in this one. I'm not counting.
Universe, but for all time to the future.
Yes, for all time to the future.
So one universe would give rise to a logic.
Yes. What?
Why do you know it's finite?
I don't know it's finite.
Oh.
But in our universe, there are various people who argue about the distant future, and it does seem like it will be finite in our universe.
Could you draw a conformal diagram for the bounds?
No, because I could, but it's not some. I mean, it's a thing that people in classical relativity and semi-classical relativity have talked about a lot, and I just like to take it in the list of assumptions. Can we come back to...
I'm not sure what the bounds... What does the bounds mean? I mean, you have a glass?
Yes.
It's a black hole.
Yes.
Inside,
yeah, so here's the singularity. Okay, so I'll do it. Here's the star which formed. Mm-hmm. Okay. Here is the singularity. Here is the outside scribe plus. Okay. And instead of there being a singularity, there is, see here is sort of r equals 0, there is some new region that gets that starts to grow.
But it's
there.
Different. It's not the described plus.
No.
It's not. Universe?
That's the definition of what these people call in the universe.
Random jumps in gravity as you get to the black hole.
Right, right.
And the fitness function is simply the number of kids you have.
Exactly, exactly.
There are no predators.
There are no predators. Yeah. There are no...
One of my colleagues said, the trouble with your theory is that there's no sex in this room.
It's hard. If you want to try, you know, I think, what's his name? At Princeton has, in fact, worked hard to put that in, and you can talk to him. Richard Gott. And you can talk to him about that. Okay?
Just because of the Adolf yet.
Yeah.
When you're defining B of T in terms of astrophysical, are you putting that term astrophysical in deliberately? Does that exclude primordial black holes?
Right? Actually, you know what? Let me just drop it. It was going to help me a minute later, but I'll do the work in a minute. So, just black holes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sorry. Let me drop that. Okay. So the situation under certain assumptions looks just like models of population biology. Those assumptions, just to write them down, okay, are that B of T is strongly varying. That is, there are points where it's very large, and in our universe it's at least 10 to the 18, and it's very easy to imagine universes in which it's of the order of 1, so I think it satisfies that.
You're assuming our Big Bang was in the same area
as
some previous.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so it's strongly varying. I want it to be, okay, not rugged. Rugged is a technical term for population biologists. It means, the first thing says that there could be peaks. The second thing says that there aren't an enormous number of peaks. Okay? And I need delta P is small compared to a sort of scale, which is like, you know, sort of derivative, the gradients of B over B. So, in other words, okay, a random jump doesn't take you from a universe with 10 to the 18 black holes to a universe with 0 black holes. It takes you to a universe with 10 to the 8. Yeah. Okay. These are the technical assumptions I need.
I like that objection.
Okay. I'm sure we'll have killing ones later. So those are my list of assumptions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's where I put my technical assumptions.
Can you say the universe is 10 to the 18 in space, so to speak, or in the future going through
this? If you count a modest proportion of supernovas leading to black holes, and, you know, like 1%, which is probably low, but a modest proportion, and one supernova per 40 years per spiral galaxy, that's what you get.
What do you do with black holes that merge and things like that? I mean,
I think there. Yeah. For that, that's an interesting question, and that depends on what you think the details of the Planck scale physics are that lead to this bounce. And let me postpone that to a discussion afterwards. Let me lay out the theory, and then we can talk about corrections to the theory. Okay.
All black holes that ever form, right? So are you assuming something about the future energy of the universe?
Well, the dominant mode, assuming, and it's an issue that I'm happy to talk at length on, assuming that there are in our universe no or very few primordial black holes, the dominant mode of black hole production in our universe is supernova remnants, is okay, on the order of, you know, few solar mass black holes from supernova remnants. Okay. And they are produced at a steady rate in spiral galaxies because of the interesting fact that spiral galaxies produce massive stars at a steady rate, which is a fascinating fact that I was floored by when I heard it, and I've been fascinated by. And that will happen as long as there is material for spiral galaxies to process into stars. And if you give estimates of how long that will be, which I'm not an expert on, but people do, it's not more than sort of another 100 billion years at the outside. Okay?
What are you assuming about the spatial volume of our universe? Obviously, you're assuming...
I'm assuming it's finite, and let me... Yeah, since it's closed, I'm assuming it's finite. But let me come back. Let me lay the whole thing out and then come back to that. But yes, I am assuming, if you want me to write that down, I'll write that down. Closed. All bounds produce spatially compact. Okay, which we can come back and criticize, but to have it there. Okay, now, okay, these are the assumptions. Okay, what does the theory predict? There's one more assumption. Okay, and the assumption is that our universe, okay, is a typical member of the ensemble. According to this theory, there is some real physical ensemble of big classical universes like our own, and our universe is one of them. And unlike the anthropic principle, and this is not to criticize them, but just to emphasize a technical difference, the goal here is to discover a property that almost every member of the ensemble has after a long time and try to falsify that. And the property that almost every member of the ensemble has after many, so there is a density, R, rho n, if you start with some random start, after n iterations, which is how I'll count time, since this is relativity, and the assumption is that as n gets large, that the properties of rho n are largely independent of the random start, assuming you started somewhere that could lead to a universe like ours. Okay. And two, that the population is distributed on the local peaks, the local maxima of assumption B. So this is a standard consequence of population biology methods given those technical assumptions, which is that rho of n is itself peaked on local maxima of B of P. Okay? With more assumptions, you can say global things, but I don't know enough physics to make more assumptions. As somebody emphasized, okay, I don't know the physics way out here very well. Okay? So, but that's enough to falsify the theory, because the theory has a consequence with all those assumptions, plus these results of population biology, which is that where we are should be somewhere near, within sort of delta T, of a local peak. Okay. And so the question is, how do you tell that you're not on a peak? You tell you're not on a peak if there's some direction where you can walk uphill quite a bit. So the theory makes a prediction, okay, which is that there is no change, okay, in P within, remember I'm restricted to the image of my map from the fundamental theory, that strongly increases B of P. That's the prediction. Okay. Now, to kill this theory, all that's necessary is to find one.
Okay.
If we don't know phi, so not knowing phi or the fundamental theory, we just cross this out, which makes the theory more vulnerable, not less vulnerable. So that's the right direction to do this. And then we can easily falsify this theory if we can violate that. So that's why this is a highly falsifiable theory.
A very important point to just make. How come we can falsify in the absence of knowing something about the image of phi? What if we find a change in a parameter which increases b, however, what we don't know is we actually aren't allowed to change that.
The image of phi might be a point. Actually, it is a point.
Well, no. The point is well taken. But in the okay, the theory becomes harder to falsify if you put in assumptions about the image of phi. Since we don't know it, I'll drop it out for the time being. Okay, and I will claim that even with this. Okay. In other words, if you come along and say, but wait a minute, if you change this and this and this, then you're in trouble. You know, I would be free to come back and argue, well, the image of phi won't let me do that. But I'm not going to do that. I would be happy to never speak about this again if we could falsify it without that. Okay? Okay.
Yeah. The obvious thing to make
the gravitation bigger,
smaller.
Yes.
By
a
factor of 10 to 10.
I will.
Why don't I get, you know, like every molecule becomes a black hole?
Well, I will come to, can I come to that in order? Because I have to lay out some assumptions about how the astronomy works. And then there is an answer. Mm-hmm. No.
Doesn't you giving up your work on the theory and the theory being
falsified? Look, I'm sorry.
Now, this may not be very important, but logically, isn't it, at least strictly speaking, isn't it conceivable that phi could vary from universe to universe? I mean, you're assuming that the same phi for all universes.
Oh, sure.
Right, but logically...
Well, if it is, then I just put it back into the space of parameters.
Phi is included in the...
Yeah. Okay. So... let me tell you where I think we are, and it includes that, and then tell you what the methodology is that has been used to think about this, and then I'm happy to open it up. Okay? So I think that there are parameters, okay, which look like this. That is, you decrease B on both sides. And these are alpha, beta, which is the electron mass. These are notations the astronomers like to use over the proton mass. Okay. The strength of the strong interactions in dimensionless units. The alpha g, which is what David was just mentioning, the Newton's constant times the proton mass squared. And alpha weak, which is the Fermi constant times the proton mass squared. Okay? No. Okay? No, because this is what I claim I think I understand. Okay? Okay. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about any of those. Okay. Then there are parameters of this form where the situation is like that. That is, there's one side where it clearly makes the number of black holes fewer. And the other side, I don't know. And they are the electron neutrino mass and the strange quark mass. Okay. And another one which is here, okay, is lambda inflaton, okay, in standard, let me emphasize that, new inflation. Okay, so that's... Right, yeah, sure. So there's sort of those guys, and guys where I don't know anything, of course.
Where you have jurisdiction.
Yes, exactly.
For example, epsilon prime over epsilon.
Right. No, I don't have predictions about epsilon prime over epsilon yet. Okay. So what is...
cosmological constants in the last category?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess the cosmological constant is here. Is there. Yeah, if we greatly increase the cosmological constant, then we don't get galaxies forming. Okay. So the methodology... okay. Except for the cosmological parameters. With the cosmological parameters, one should worry about primordial black holes. Okay. So the methodology comes in two steps. Step one is primordial. And this is mainly varying of lambda in Flatton, cosmological constant, etc. Okay. And then ordinary supernova remnants. It's the parameter that that governs the self-interaction of the scalar field. Okay. And to look at the supernova remnants, the thing that you want to look at is kind of critical events. That is, you know, the universe starts off, and by some time, 100 times the present Hubble time, there are a certain number of black holes that have been made. What were the critical events that channeled that matter in the direction of black holes? And so the things that you have to worry about, okay, are the size of the classical region of the universe and delta rho over rho, the size of the fluctuations. You have to worry about galaxies forming. Then within galaxies, there is this very interesting kind of nonlinear system with lots of feedback, which a disk galaxy runs on, which leads to a situation where the ingredients of massive stars get produced at a constant rate and turned into massive stars at a constant rate. And we have to worry about those. The first is giant molecular cloud cooling or formation, which is a sort of problem of phase transition or cooling. Okay. And the important thing in here is constant rate. Okay. That is, I mean, galaxies produce stars for a very long time. So things which are episodic have to be huge if they disrupt the constant rate of formation of massive stars. Okay, so we focus on the constant rate. Okay. Then there is the process which catalyzes the formation of massive stars from giant molecular clouds, which is called self-propagated star formation. And what's interesting is that this has to do with the effects of the massive stars. Okay? And particularly here is supernovas, although also ionization regions play a role. But astronomers tell me the dominant effect is supernovas. Okay? Then the stars that are going to yield black holes themselves supernova. So we have to worry about that. Okay. And finally, we want, okay, we have the remnants, and we want as many as possible of the remnants to be black holes rather than neutron stars, which don't do us any good. Okay. So those are the six stages that we have to think about and talk about.
Are you somehow assuming that the initial conditions were very smooth in the universe? And what if they were very lumpy? Right? Wouldn't you have lots more
black holes? I'm going on forever.
But why don't you reproduce?
I am willing to take as a working assumption, okay, for this as input all the standard things that astronomers and cosmologists believe. And astronomers, most astronomers and cosmologists believe, for some interesting reasons, okay, although it's still not proven in inflation, and I'm willing to take inflation on as a standard assumption. And the game, this game is rather, the early part of this game is very different, of course, with and without inflation.
Inflation is an assumption, it's a statement about
the right.
The standard model and sufficient initial conditions.
Ah,
okay,
yes.
Initial conditions, without varying a single parameter, if you make the universe very, very lumpy, inflation won't occur, and you'll get
You'll get an arbitrarily large number of black holes in a very small universe. And when I chase that down, okay. If you like, I'll talk about what I know, what I understand about this. So let me talk about.
Doesn't that make
BFP go up? No, because the size is so. Let me talk about that. It's not a per unit volume or per mass. It's a to the future of the singularity. It's a total number.
Total number in space?
Yeah.
Total number
form to the future of the bounce.
So if it bounces 150 times.
No. To the future of one bounce. You count the black holes that form in the future of one bounce, and then you stop there. You don't go through a bounce and then count those.
Total number formed between.
Between bounces. In, if you like, in. Okay.
To the future of one bounce, because
yeah. Okay. For example, to talk about the. Okay. As a function. So. Let me assume good enough initial conditions in your sense, then I'll come back and criticize that. So, in the standard new inflation, which is not the only version of inflation on the market, okay, the
one.
Oh, you want me to jump
to?
Okay. Okay, I'm at your service. At your service. Okay. Newton's constant is the most complicated. I'll come back. I will. Yes, don't worry. I'll do both. I'm here to you till you shut me up. Okay. There are several places where interesting bounds on, we're not talking about alpha G, come from. Okay. One of them is that the time scale for the lifetime of a star goes like 1 over alpha G. Okay. And if I get something wrong in powers, I'm sure the astronomers will correct me. No, we're doing alpha G. Okay? I'll come back. Okay. Okay. So this is.
So time scale for life of the star is under what? Assuming it undergoes a nuclear reaction. I don't need the star as mock if I have alpha G of the order 10 to the minus 3. I don't need the star as molecule to become black hole.
My thing is, thank you, is local change. All I have to show, I don't care that there may be some peak up there. Okay?
Why don't you care?
Why? Because it's easier. I'm happy to come back and talk about that. But there are so many things that change when you go, let me do what I... The idea is to use...
This would falsify the model if there were a much bigger peak. Yeah.
No, it's not necessarily because all that I have to do to work over here, okay, is assume, I mean, phi, the image of phi includes us, so it's a weak assumption that the image of phi includes some things around us. That the image of phi includes things way over here is a stronger assumption about phi. So I'd rather take them one at a time.
No, that's defensible. It's just going to take a long time to reach a peak. I mean,
you know, for us to have an ion in the third ion in the back of our head is a very good thing to increase our fitness, but it just takes a long time to grow that third ion. You're a biologist.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
yeah.
a huge
piece. Yeah. Look, my strong guess is that the theory is going to be falsified right here. And in fact, if you let me go on long enough, I'll tell you the three places where I think the theory is going to be falsified. Okay?
Maybe it's just so much. Why do you avoid predators if you have a lot of black holes? Why is that a good thing?
It's not that you avoid them. The model itself has no predators.
Okay, so but why is that a fitness thing,
the number of black holes? Oh, if you read the textbooks in population biology, predators are not the key thing of the whole thing. Predators are totally, happens to be true that a small number of species are vulnerable to predators and that changes their fitness, but it's not part of the general framework.
So
it's
black holes.
Each black hole gives enough right to the universe.
The more black holes, the
okay.
more
okay. So
why is it reasonable to assume that one universe could get the universe is very similar to it? I mean, I understand it with...
Oh, that's
just an assumption.
That, yeah, without that, one can do nothing. And I should say that without that, okay, you can find these ideas in Misna Thorne Wheeler and Johnny Wheeler's writings in the early 60s. The thing that makes it a falsifiable theory is that assumption. Okay.
So you're only allowing, what, 10% change?
I'm allowing till the first threshold. That goes up until you hit a threshold where something goes up or something goes down. That's what I can analyze. I don't think my knowledge of astronomy is good enough to walk across a threshold and cross it, but you can ask either what's the rate of change when you start to walk, or do you walk, which is usually the case, and then you hit a threshold which goes up or down. And that's the issue. Okay. Now, the basic point is that galaxies, let me just say this here, okay? Galaxies produce stars, okay, at a constant rate, okay, because alpha G is very small. Okay? Not only are there stars, but there are some important separations of scales. Okay? In order for a large proportion of the giant molecular clouds to get hit by shock waves coming from supernova, okay, and in order that when that happens, as apparently in nature, a lot of massive stars get made, because massive stars are produced in clusters rather than one, it requires that the time of a massive star, okay, which by the way goes like the mass over sort of the Chandrasekhar mass squared, okay, this time must be a lot greater than the collapse time for a giant molecular cloud, and it must be also less than the rotation time of a spiral galaxy. And this collapse time, the collapse times turn out to go like 1 over the square root of alpha g. And that constraint, oh, M is its mass, and M star is the Chandrasekhar mass. So the heavier stars live a lot.
M star depends on alpha G.
Oh, yeah, but I've taken that. Fine. I'm illustrating two things at the same time. So let me just write them as separate equations. T of a star of mass M goes also like M Chandrasekhar over M squared. Okay? And if you want, so this time goes like 1 over alpha G. Okay, this is one of, I'll present several arguments about alpha G. Okay, this goes like 1 over alpha G. If alpha G becomes too big, then the stars that are going to supernova and become black holes, supernova and become black holes before most of the other stars in their star cluster are going to form, and therefore you might get one black hole from a giant molecular cloud, but you'll never get more than one, and that cuts efficiency. On the other side, if you tune alpha G the other way, so that the supernova time is on the order of 100 million years rather than 10 million years, then most giant molecular clouds will just dissipate by being quietly burned off from the light stars that they formed, and you won't get many massive stars at all. So that's one argument. Another argument...
Is there some function that the luminosity function of the stars is not changing?
No, this is built in. This argument is...
See, I mean, part of the problem is
Okay.
I mean, can you imagine a scenario? We were starting out by giving, I recognize university produced a lot of black holes, and you have no way of conceiving ahead of time a scenario that's going to produce more black holes.
Yeah, and I'm surprised by that. I'm surprised.
Yeah, but then you're sort of never going to falsify this by following this argument. Everything you try is going to lead you away from where you are and what you're comfortable with as a mechanism for producing black holes. And as you said, you can't imagine another peak.
No. David. No, we're sitting here. Okay. Wait. Okay. We're sitting here. Okay. It seems to me. Okay. No, it's not. This is not a question of my personal prejudice. This is a question of talking with many good astronomers.
And none of them have come up with a conceivable another local maximum nearby.
Well, we don't even know that we're at a local maximum. I mean...
He had positive derivatives there. He's not going to argue. We can sit back and try to quantitatively that within that much greater than and much less than there's room to move. He's not going to argue that you're at a true maximum.
Well...
By change by a million...
I don't think we know enough to ask about changing a million... But David, since you asked, let me...
It's hopeless. I mean,
it's not hopeless.
To falsify your thing, you have to invent a different universe,
sure.
A different...
So I'm very happy to explain to you.
Yeah. And a path to it that wouldn't go too far in the
front. Let me mention some ways in which it's very vulnerable to being falsified. Okay? Another... important process here. Look, nobody jumped at supernovas, okay? But let me emphasize what supernovas do. Okay? Supernovas, okay, turn stars which have just died, which would definitely be black holes, because they're definitely over the neutron star upper mass limit, okay? By exploding most of the material out, replace that by a situation where the issue is not, is this 8 or 10 or 25 solar mass star certainly going to become a black hole? 2, is the remnant which is left over, which is on the order of 1 or a few solar masses, going to become a black hole? Okay. So if you could turn off supernovas, okay, you would think at first sight you could easily kill this theory. So people have thought about turning off supernovas. And I think everybody knows these things, so let me make myself... And the interesting thing is that the existence of supernovas, this, like many of the insights here, comes from Bernard Carr and Martin Rees, is that there is a relation between the parameters which seems necessary for supernovas, and that's the weak coupling constant is related to the fourth power. These are just made dimensionless with the proton mass. Well, that's in alpha. This is... This is not what you think. This is just the proton mass squared times the observed Fermi constant.
Yeah, I'm just saying, if I turn off the neutral current...
Yes? I don't think it would, but I'm not an expert. Neutrinos don't come from charge. Is there an expert here on that? Okay, I think they both contribute. Let me give the argument. Okay, the argument is that the neutrinos are made in the core, okay, and I don't whether they're made by P plus E minus goes to N plus neutrino, or whether they're made by E plus E minus goes to two neutrinos. Is that true? If that's true, then let no, but through neutral currents?
No, no, but they, people did not manage to get supernova that explode before the neutral current.
Fine. Okay.
I could turn that off.
Fine. So what happens if you turn that off? Okay. No, just to tell you, what happens if you... Okay. If you turn that off, okay, then there are no supernova. If you want to turn it on, you can't just turn it on. It turns out you have to turn it on such that this relationship is true. That's the point. So here is the one... Okay, so here... Well, this is here. So here is a product of the amplitude to have produced the neutrinos and for them to have been absorbed in the envelope. So if you... Okay, so if you turn off the neutral currents, the claim is they go right through the envelope. Okay, fine. So I think what you want is there's a sort of square root of alpha W and alpha W prime, where this is charged. Let me just write charged and neutral.
It just seems to me to be inconceivable that you can't decrease the number. I mean, people find it so hard to get supernova. Okay.
Well, nature doesn't find it hard. They're very sure.
No, people find it very hard.
Right.
So, there are plenty of things that make it very
difficult. You're going to say something else goes wrong if we just turn off the supernova.
Yeah, so I'm going to say, if you turn off the supernova, okay, you would think you're home free, because every massive star that comes to the end of its burning is going to become a black hole. But then this process of self-propagated star formation is extremely suppressed because the supernovas are the dominant contribution to the shock waves that catalyze the formation of massive stars.
Okay.
So, and when you try to make that quantitative, when you try to make that quantitative, okay, which you have to do. I mean, you have to imagine that... Well, the problem is then there's no recycling. In a galaxy without supernovas, okay, there's no recycling. You may make some first generation of stars, okay, and there's a whole literature about how to make your first generation of stars without metals. Okay, and that literature, unfortunately, people disagree about whether you get more massive stars or less massive stars. Okay. But even if you buy the assumption of that you get more massive stars as the first generation, you get an enhancement early in the production of black holes early, and then you get very few astrophysical black holes after that. And when I run the numbers, I come to the conclusion that even though many more of that first generation of massive stars become black holes, okay, the total rate of production of black holes has gone down. So that's a place where it's surprising. Okay, because...
Do you want to say the number of supernova is now maximal? You have more of them? What if you had more of them?
If you had... Well, it's hard. If you had more of them, you have the number of supernova is a function of how steeply falls off the initial mass function, which is the distribution of masses of stars, okay, and it's just a straight line, it's log masses of stars with number, okay, and to make many more supernova and massive stars, you have to figure out a way to raise that power, and you also have to figure out a way to raise that power, okay, without suppressing the cooling of giant molecular clouds. Okay. And the problem with this, you can just think, you know, you go and you look at some papers on star formation and people think, nobody really thinks they understand where that power comes from, but there are papers you can look at and take a model. The problem is that all the parameters that go into that model, okay, are just the standard parameters of atomic physics and nuclear physics, and you have to ask, am I free to vary those without disrupting the cooling of giant molecular clouds. So then you come to the subject of why are there giant molecular clouds? And the answer is that there are giant molecular clouds because there's lots of carbon and lots of oxygen around. And the main cooling mechanism of the giant molecular clouds is carbon monoxide vibrations. Without carbon monoxide, the next dominant cooling method is H2, which is what people try to make stars from in at high redshift before there was carbon, and is not nearly as efficient and doesn't produce nearly as many massive stars because it doesn't cool as much. You also need carbon because your giant molecular cloud is sitting in an environment where there are lots of massive stars radiating in the UV. Otherwise, it wouldn't be interesting. Okay? And you need to shield the gas from that, and that's done with dust, which is made up of carbon and water and other things like that. So you need to have your stars go to carbon and produce carbon in reasonably copious amounts in order to have giant molecular clouds, in order to get more massive stars.
Okay. Yeah. So you say what you're mostly interested in is that a small change is about what we see today will increase and decrease.
Yes.
Okay, so completely turning off neutron stars sounds like a pretty big,
supernovas.
Sounds like a pretty big change.
What is a small change? Can you define that for us?
No, a change is until the first threshold, the first threshold, until you hit the first thing that happens. So what seems to be, by the way,
yes. What stops you from just decreasing the maximum mass of neutron stars?
Oh, thank you for that question. Thank you very much for that question. So the question that Gary has asked is, what about the maximum mass that a neutron star can have? Okay. Now, the maximum mass that a neutron star can have is a function of the neutron star's equation of state. Okay. There is my understanding of the situation is that there are, in the literature, several different proposals for the constituents of neutron star material, which have different consequences for the equation of state. There is normal, those neutron stars are made of neutrons. Okay. And they predict a relatively, there are various ways that people parameterize the equation of state, but they all get an upper mass limit, which is what it's called. Nobody's seen well, but the actual value of the upper mass limit for right, okay. And it's hard to compute, sure, and it's somewhere between 2 to 3 solar masses, okay, depending on the assumptions. Wait, okay, this is standard, okay. Then there is beta brown matter, okay, which is a K condensate. And this is something which is controversial among nuclear physicists and astronomers, and I'll try to explain it for the purposes of people who don't know about it, and then I'll be interested in people's opinion about it. Okay. They claim that because K minus is bound strongly to nucleons, that what happens in the when a star is collapsing is that the electrons convert to K minuses because the effective mass of a K minus in sufficiently dense nuclear matter is less than the mass of the electron in that, and therefore you end up with a star dominated by a K condensate and protons and neutrons, as a result of which, since you have two species of fermions, the equation of state is softer, and the upper mass limit, they claim after calculations, okay, which it's not clear whether one should trust, but they claim that you get 1.5 solar masses. Okay.
These are just ambiguities, I mean, it's just because it's a typical
Mendeley
problem to do calculations.
There's
only one answer.
Sure. Well, okay. But what you can deduce from Beta and Brown, even if you don't trust, they do their calculations in second-order chiral perturbation theory. And chiral perturbation theory in the kaon mass is not great. So, okay, one doesn't trust much more than the signs. of their calculations. But the signs are interesting because what their calculation says is that there is a sufficiently, there is a value of the strange quark mass. So let me graph the strange quark mass here. There is a value of the strange quark mass, bare mass, such that the K condensate will form in nuclear matter before the standard process happens of protons and electrons converting. And that is, so the point is that there is some MS star such that below here is a beta Brown star and above here is a normal neutron star. And that you can get just from the physics of their scenario without their calculations. So if you graph the upper mass limit, it looks like that. Again, just from the rough physics. Okay. And so you can make the following argument. Okay. Their calculations are not good enough to show exactly where this is. Because they're chiral perturbation theory kind of calculations. So I don't know if we trust them or we don't trust them. But we certainly trust that if this is actually below the it's either above or below the present value. Okay. Supposing that it's below the present value, okay, then if the present value is here, then the upper mass limit could be lowered dramatically by decreasing the strange quark mass. And so then there is a way that nature did not take advantage of for making many more black holes from supernova remnants. Therefore, the theory predicts that, in fact, the real world better be here. Okay. And therefore, all that's needed to falsify this theory, one of the easy ways to falsify this theory, is discover one two-solar mass neutron star and convince the astronomical community that it really is a two-solar mass neutron star. Then Beta and Brown are wrong. And then there is a way to walk up the hill, which is decreasing the strange quark mass. All the ones which are well measured, i.e. by binary pulsars, are all between 1.3 and 1.45, which fits nicely below this. Okay. Well, there is one candidate, which is by X-ray binary, if I understand right, which is controversial. Okay.
Please, I don't want to introduce a sort of speculative note here.
Very good. Okay. Okay.
Would you predict that, for example, advanced civilizations that were capable of moving a lot of matter around would evolve the light to form more black holes than to push matter together to make it?
That argument. Jim, you may not know that there is a literature on that about that proposal, coming off of this proposal, and it has very smart people in it, like Harrison, the Harrison of the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum, and like Lewis Crane, and so that has been discussed. Okay.
It explains a lot. It explains why we don't see them.
But anyway, let me. I did say I would come back to inflation. So can I say something about inflation? Okay. So this is. Well, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's say that we were master calculators and we could compute the function that gives us the maximum mass of the neutron star, the function of the parameters.
Yes.
Picture that function in your mind. Okay?
Yeah.
I can take its derivative, partial derivative, with respect to any parameter. And unless it's sort of completely specially constructed, it seems sort of absolutely conceivable that, you know, the derivative that it's somehow non-analytic with respect to every parameter. So
no, no, but
parabolic.
But Ted,
it's parabolic with respect to every parameter.
No. Wait. Ted, there's a big constraint. The constraint that giant molecular clouds form and cool efficiently requires that carbon be efficiently produced in cars, and that's in stars. And that's a huge constraint. Okay. That's why the strange quark mass is so nice. Because until you get the strange quark mass down much lower, where it becomes a significant constituent of protons and neutrons, okay, the rate of formation of giant molecular clouds is probably not much affected by changing the strange quark mass. So that's why that's a good argument.
This is the one example of in order to really falsify, I think you have to be able to see another peak, another phase, if you want, mechanism. This is an example.
Yes.
Where you're concentrating on something where you know how to falsify because you can imagine a different phase.
Yes.
One which is qualitatively different than a normal neutron, but only affects stuff. I mean, that's why you're able to falsify.
Right.
In cases where you can't imagine another qualitatively different universe in any aspect, you're never going to be able to.
I think I discussed several examples of that.
Modern biologists can be thinking about mutations that would improve.
It is complicated, but turning off supernovas is pretty. What the astrophysicists who I've talked to say is that either decreasing or increasing the effective Fermi constant, which governs the interactions of neutrinos and supernovas.
Okay.
No, it's true that literature is actually, it's about the same time as neutral currents. But anyway, it doesn't mention neutral currents. It's easy for us to put neutral currents in. And one can reach the conclusion that either increasing or decreasing the strength of the weak interactions by, and I think it's true of either one, since you make them with charged currents and they scatter with neutral currents, okay, will, by a factor of 3 on either side, will turn off supernovas. And turning off supernovas is easy to imagine what happens. And it's not easy, but given present astronomy, it's possible to imagine what happens. And the surprising thing is that it goes in the direction opposite to what you expect. Okay. But let me come back. People are about. Let me come back and talk about inflation. Okay. So. Okay. And this is standard inflation with one parameter. And then I can talk about non-standard inflation. Standard inflation is one parameter, lambda. Okay. And what do we know about lambda? We know delta rho over rho is proportional to lambda. We know the size of the inflation of the region which blows up is
proportional.
Because that's what comes out of the standard rolling down the.
Oh, it came out of a particular assumption of the initial condition.
Yeah, so let me. I'm making that standard. I said I would make that standard assumption and then we can criticize it. Okay. We also know that the size of the region, that the region after you come out of reheating is something of the order of L sort of unified cube times e to the number of e foldings, and we know that the number of e-foldings goes like 1 over the square root of lambda, again, in standard inflation. So this goes like e to the 1 over square root of lambda. We also know that there are some thresholds. We know from Mikenko, Unruh, and Wald that if lambda is greater than some critical value, which is about, depends on the model, but it's on the order of 10 to the minus 6, there is no inflation because the field doesn't settle down smoothly enough. And it also seems that there should be a lower value, that there should be, so we want lambda to be less than that. Lambda should be greater than some minimum value, otherwise the fluctuations are not large enough for any galaxies to be formed. And without galaxies, we're not going to get black holes. So the situation is that therefore, B looks like close to zero outside these thresholds, L minimum, L, what did I call it, critical. And in there, it goes like e to the minus 1 over square root of lambda times some power of delta rho over rho, which we don't know. It's probably something like quadratic. It's the number of black holes that gets made is some power of the scale of the fluctuation. So let's just say lambda to the p. Okay. So what does that look like? That looks like that. Okay. Therefore, the prediction is that the inflaton coupling should be as small as possible, because what wins is making the region that inflates as large as possible, that is making n as possible. This also means that omega total better be 1, so I have to buy in to omega total being 1.
Isn't the region that inflates almost always infinitely big?
No, there's well, that's Linde, et cetera. That's, I was good.
But it's also
true.
You derive it from right now the potential and calculate it. It's not a different model.
Well, but wait a minute. I started with some assumption that there was this matter which was collapsing, which formed a star, was collapsing, and I'm concerned with what's happening at the center of the star. So I'm concerned with, you know, does this material, as it's approaching grand unified densities, go into the inflationary phase transition? God has also modeled this.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is once you start it inflating, some of the universe will fall out of inflation while some stays in. And there's always some that stays in, forever in future. So if you wait until inflation ends, since it doesn't ever end, then L will be infinitely big.
Well, first of all, I'm talking about one region that that reheats, where inflation stops and reheats. Can I finish saying this and we talk about, because I'm not at all convinced about the internal inflation, but I'm willing to, I don't think it's inconsistent with this. I'm just not not convinced by some aspects of it. But let me, what I get from here, okay, is, and I think internal inflation would just, you know, increase all these predictions, that the inflaton coupling should be the smallest possible that makes galaxies. So in particular, galaxies should form late. We should buy scenarios where galaxies form late rather than early. We should buy n being as large as possible, so omega total is close to 1. Right? And this is again a prediction if something like the standard inflationary model is the true dynamics that drives the inflaton, then these are predictions from this theory, okay? Which are real predictions which could be falsified. For example, if omega total is less than 1, okay, which until the recent supernova stuff was what it was looking like astronomically. Okay. So that's also quite vulnerable, I think, because...
But there are a whole lot of other parameters we're trying to use standard. Namely, the spatial gradients have to be sufficiently small in order to get inflation at all.
Well, I agree with you, and that presumably all those parameters are somewhere in here, and we're not.
That's the theory. That's the dynamical theory. That's the standard model.
You're saying that my discussion of inflation has to be supplemented by a theory of the initial conditions.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Fine. Okay.
Then, right, and then you can think of lots of ways of making more black holes, right, by varying just the initial condition. Just make it more irregular. Right?
Well,
right.
So let me now.
Okay.
So now there's the primordial black hole thing. So.
I'm sorry. Even within what you were allowing yourself to play with the parameters. There's also the spectral index of the function.
Yeah, I was about to say that. The spectral index, okay, is not part of the standard inflationary theory. It's part of some new inflationary theories. Okay. If you have a theory where the tilt parameter, there's another name for it, can vary independently of the parameter that determines n, okay, then you can easily vary that parameter, increase the tilt, and make lots of primordial black holes. Okay.
Or even late
black holes. Well, for one thing, you can make lots of... Because the point is that if delta rho over rho is decoupled from n, then you can make n as big as you like, and you can make as many primordial black holes as you like. Okay. So Another way that this theory could be falsified would be a discovery that the tilt parameter in the cosmic microwave background spectrum was not the one given by the simplest possible theory, but was one that was inconsistent with the simplest possible theory, because that would strongly suggest there was another parameter in the game. And then you would have to ask, why wasn't that other parameter varied to make lots of primordial black holes? So that's another way that the theory could be falsified.
Is the assumption of this, of what you're calling the simplest possible theory, just that the potential is m squared pi squared plus lambda pi to 4?
I think there's some...
usually potentials have a lot more parameters than just one, so I'm wondering
what... Well, the key assumption is that delta rho over rho is inversely with the square of n. Which
does
is
that come out of choosing some form of a potential?
That's in the potential that you mentioned. It's also in whatever the logarithmic potential that was in the Albrecht and Steinhardt paper. Okay. So I agree. There are lots of other inflationary theories, and in them, this theory predicts that they are not allowed by the fundamental theory, and that the standard inflationary theory requires this coupling, which is in what were the first standard models of inflation. Okay. This also, as we know, I mean, let me emphasize, okay, omega total being 1 looks really bad unless you happen to really believe these supernova results. So this is very vulnerable.
Although, wouldn't you have made one black hole, so will omega matter being 1 and the function
be 0? That's an interesting question. Then you're raising then you're lowering the photon to baryon ratio. Okay, and I haven't talked about that, but lowering the photon to baryon ratio, if I remember right.
It doesn't have to be baryon.
Well, photon to matter. Okay, in the nucleosynthesis thing, you may know this better than me, puts us in the regime where we make hydrogen, where the universe is made out of hydrogen. And
certainly exchanging the energy and the cosmological content for cold dark matter would not have any such effect. I mean, that is what until recently we thought.
Fine. But I don't have any problem with that. I mean,
for baryons, it's not so good.
Yeah. Increasing the number of baryons, I think, has this danger of increasing. I don't remember this, but my memory is it puts us into a universe which is all helium, and the universe which is all helium is really different. And certainly there aren't giant molecular clouds, the self-propagating star formation doesn't happen, but there what happens, I think, is a research problem. I mean, I don't think that at least I'm smart enough to say how many black holes would have been formed in an all helium universe.
But we certainly wouldn't be here in such a universe. Why don't you just throw those out from the ensemble?
So you're suggesting that I should only play this game in a little region in which we are.
Well, yeah, because if some variation would not only produce more black holes, but would disallow us to exist.
But the problem is that what I'd like to be true...
It's not necessarily false.
No, I understand what you're saying, and that makes the theory harder to falsify. The ground rules I set up for myself are defined a property which is true on the basis of the scenario of almost every member of the ensemble and try to falsify that without using something special about us. Okay. And that's what I think if we want the theory to explain things like that there is carbon, we have to leave us out of it. So, for example, according to this theory, I can say, if this theory is true, the reason why there is carbon is not because we're here. The reason why there's carbon is that almost every member of the ensemble discovered how to make carbon in order to cool giant molecular clouds in order to make massive stars. And that becomes a genuine explanation, which is not possible if I play the game your way. But it would be a genuine insight and would be a genuine explanation.
So what about parameters that I bet had no impact on the
world? Well, so like the it's interesting to play...
Top
I don't know about the top neutrino quark mass, but the top quark mass, the thing that I've wanted
top
to find...
Quark mass,
the top neutrino mass. Well, if the neutrino masses are in the light are in the right range, of course, they contribute a lot to dark matter, and that affects galaxy formation. But presumably, that's not true of the. Okay. Yeah. But what's interesting is the top quark mass, if it affects the number of magnetic monopoles, say in SU5 grand unified theory or something like that. The number of magnetic monopoles is important because if there are a lot more magnetic monopoles, there would be a lot weaker magnetic field. And if there were a lot weaker magnetic fields.
I'm just talking about changes of 50%, you know, the small changes, 10%, 20%. You're not allowed to just make big changes. It seems to me that there are some of those, you know, for most of the parameters of the standard model, you're going to have ranges of 100% that you're not going to be able to think of an effect of having a black hole formation.
For these. Yeah, for the not so, lowest generation, so, sure.
But David, you'll be careful because given the neutrino masses that we extrapolate from the super Gamma-Conde, they are just low enough to not suppress the formation of black holes. If they were, they're about 10% of the mass density of Baranov. If they're much higher, they would suppress small scale fluctuations. So they would contribute to the dynamics.
For what?
The dynamics, mm-hmm. The dark matter dynamics.
Yeah.
They would flow out of overdense regions and suppress small scale fluctuations, and presumably therefore suppress the formation of stars and black holes.
But presumably the basic point that if you're thinking of this as being like biology, there should be some room for dramatic drift. There should be some directions in parameter space that are near enough flat that you can move around in them and not.
Sure. Sure. I mean, a consequence of this is that another way to say it is not every decimal point of every parameter would be fixed. I mean, at some point there is always drift. But I'm not, by the way, I don't get much benefit. I mean, besides the analogy to population biology, one doesn't get much benefit about, you know, quote, thinking like biology. In fact, the embarrassing thing is that this model of the model of population biology, which is isomorphic to this, is not a very good model of biology, and biologists don't much use anymore because it neglects the interaction between different species and so forth. So it's not, you know, real biology is much harder and much more complicated than this. So I think I said some of the ways that this could be falsified. Let me just mention one last. Okay, I mentioned this parameter of the initial mass function here. Okay, it's controversial whether when one turns off carbon and oxygen, that is, has no metals, whether this goes up or goes down. Okay, if this theory is true, that is, there are different calculations by different astrophysicists that reach different conclusions. There's even a paper by Tegmark and Martin Rees and so forth that has two sections, in one of which it goes down and the other which it goes up, and they can't decide which way it is. This theory has to predict that it goes down when you turn off carbon. Okay. Otherwise, there would have been no reason that the universe made stars, made galaxies, and made giant molecular clouds and so forth from the point of view of making more black holes, and that leads to a prediction, which is that the initial mass function was steeper at earlier times, and that leads to predictions, for example, like bounds on the number of supernova before the medium was enriched, and that's something which is not now testable, but going to be testable from the next generation space telescope, because they're going to be able to see supernova out to high Z, like Z of 10. And they had better not see very many. If they see lots of supernova at Z of 10, then that's another way that this theory is disconfirmed. So there are lots of ways that this theory will probably be disconfirmed. Okay. Thanks.